Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Also joining us today from IBM is Brenda Dixon.
So, General Green, you and I have talked in the past about the concept of disruptive innovation. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you think that might apply to the Air Force medical service and what your vision is for how the medical service can be disrupted?
It is a tough thing in a bureaucracy to kind of create that disruptive innovation. What I try and do is bring people up from basically out in the hinterlands, okay, who are doing the job, and have them tell me the things that aren't working very well. And we get them to tell us how it could be done better. One of the things, it was kind of a misstep on my part when I first became the deputy surgeon, was to try and solve some issues in terms of our primary care by creating a rotational model that would try and create stability. I learned rather quickly, talking with the people out in the field, that there wasn't enough manpower for them to do the job as we wanted them to. After sitting down with seven different representatives from seven facilities, we came up with a concept that we called the Family Health Initiative. And the Family Health Initiative was a way to try and improve Air Force primary care practice by essentially changing it from primary care, where you were seeing any patient who called to get an appointment, to something that was more team-based and patient-centered by allowing the patient continuity with a provider. We had worked towards this over a number of years and hadn't achieved it. And we put out a new model that we, as we said, called the Family Health Initiative. And as we looked at it, it turned out that it was so similar to what the American Academy of Family Practice was calling patient-centered medical home that we essentially said that our Family Health Initiative would be a transition to patient-centered medical home. Now, we have set up patient-centered medical home at 13 facilities in 2009, and this year we've added another 10. Next year, I hope to have all of our facilities across the Air Force in the patient-centered medical home concept. By the end of September, I'll have 330,000 patients that now have a single provider and a team of professionals that are responsible for their care. By the end of 2012, I'll have 1 million beneficiaries that will have that type of access. Now, why is that disruptive? Well, remember, I live in a system where my providers typically move every 3 years and where my patients move every 3 years. And so to try and create continuity in a system that's moving like that, not even including the deployments, is kind of unheard of. And yet our initial results at the first bases where we stood this up 2 years ago, they've gone from having about 30% of the time that you saw the same physician to about 70% of the time you see the same physician. And 95% of the time you're seeing the physician or his partner who's an extender, whether nurse practitioner or PA. And that's what we want. And if you do change assignments and go somewhere else, you'll get a new doctor and a new physician extender. But the reality is you'll know that there's the same team that's there to watch after you, and it creates that trust that I'm seeking.
So besides continuity of care, can you tell us a little bit more about what is important for the patient-centered medical home concepts that is driving improved quality of service?
Well, I started off early in the interview talking about my desire to try and make certain that people were as healthy as they possibly could be before they would deploy. Not just our medical people, but all of our beneficiaries. Because it's not so much that I want to do work in health. I'd rather that everybody was healthy and I was just on standby mode. And so one of the things that I've put in motion is something that I called patient-centered precision care. And precision care has to do with trying to tie genetic information so that we can actually reach out directly to a patient that's now in these medical homes and offer them a level of prevention and a futuristic plan for how we will take new information to improve their prevention over the next 50 years. I'm going to bring informatics to bear so that when we see evidence that's associated with genetic information, we're going to start basically applying that out to the patient directly. So to get there, there are several steps. I had to have people in these medical homes. I have to have secure patient messaging, the ability to reach out and tell these patients something that's new or something that may affect their health. And I have to have the ability to manage huge volumes of data. And so if you think about it, we're doing a lot of genetic testing today based on different medications or lab tests or cancer interventions. I want to partner with a host of organizations that are collecting this information. I want to put it in a repository. I want to protect it. And as part of a study, I want to basically look at associations. And today, where you'll see an association with maybe three or four base pairs, tomorrow, I think you may see an association of a disease with someone who has a common 10,000 base pairs. I now will know who has those 10,000 base pairs, and I'll reach out to them wherever they're assigned in one of my medical homes and say, a new finding has suggested that you may benefit from this discussion. Now, there's another piece. I have to have clinical decision support so that physicians who are out there are also ready to take this information and apply it to their physician. And so we have programs that are being developed today that can take today's known evidence-based medicine and apply it to a patient. Think about it. An FDA warning comes out with a black box warning, which is what they send to pharmacies to let them know there's some medication that has a new risk. Today, that goes out to the pharmacies. The pharmacies basically look through their books, and the patient may find out about it in days, weeks, sometimes months. And what I'd like to have is that all happens in seconds to minutes. And so if we can get the information to the patient that rapidly and get that information to the doctor, then instead of things taking 14 to 17 years today in terms of how innovations reach a new clinical practice, I want to get it down to where it doesn't take years, but to where it takes minutes for things to get into a physician's hands to deal with a patient who may have a problem they never even thought about.
General, how does the patient-centered medical home model represent a fundamental shift in the patient-doctor relationship, and how does it facilitate the military health system's quadruple aim?
Well, the quadruple aim starts with readiness, of course, and we've talked a lot about that. But then the second piece of that is better health. The third piece is better care, and finally, best value. The better health is where the big bang for the buck is here, because the goal is, if I can take it to the level I'm talking about, then in the medical home, where they now know this patient better than anyone, I can have what I'm calling an applied clinical epidemiology cell, pass information to the physician that the patient may have no signs or symptoms and not even realize that they're at risk. But because I know where the patient's assigned, I know how to reach out and touch those folks because of these databases that are actually feeding information to the physicians. That allows me to make sure that their health is the very best. It also allows me to improve the care of the physician, because that physician now has decision support that he wouldn't have known that this was something even to consider on this patient. I'll use an example. There's information today. It's not yet evidence to where we can apply it, but there's evidence today that one of the associations genetically is between presenile dementia and cholesterol levels. If your LDL is too high and you have a certain genetic structure, you may well be prone to presenile dementia. When I talk with multiple audiences and tell someone who's in their 30s that if I could basically put them on a statin drug and try and decrease their LDL at a much earlier age, and that would delay presenile dementia by 10 or 15 years, how many people do you think would start that medication? And so it's these kinds of things I think we need to be looking at, because we can learn and basically set up multiple Framingham studies to basically study what we know about genetics, to apply information about common genetics at a much earlier age, and see if we can't promote longevity and much better health.
So switching gears a little bit, tell us a little bit more about how you are working to look at groups of patients. So you have stood up you're working with the MHS Population Health Portal. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
We have had some experience with aggregating data. And so today, in what we call our Population Health Portal, we have nearly 80 terabytes of information. This is not the electronic health record, but it does extract certain elements of data from the electronic health record. It also then links that with billing data and all of the ICD-9 codes, which tells us about people's diseases. And it links it with their pharmaceutical data, as well as the DEER system, which tells us about our beneficiaries. When you take all of those databases together, you end up with huge amounts of data that has to be filtered to become information. To try and create that information, We've taken a group of people that are tied to our multiple consultants in various specialties and built what we call an applied clinical epidemiology cell. These folks filter the best evidence-based medicine, and through a program now that's called CarePoint, where we basically will do the physician decision support, we allow folks to see this data, which has now been taken and created into information packets, so that they can look at their assigned population and see where they should focus their efforts to best improve health. That's also where I want to put the genetic information when it comes out and leverage this new program called CarePoint. Because I do believe that when you're dealing with these huge volumes of information, when you're talking 80 terabytes of data, you've got to have something that breaks it into manageable chunks and gets it so that you can define and target specific areas where you want to make a difference. And that's why we're working with industry leaders in terms of ways to make information from data, not just on an experimental basis, but also to take what's known today and then apply that to the databases, pull that out, and apply it today.
You mentioned in working on this genetic initiative, you mentioned working with various partners that you're doing that and you'd like to continue to do that. Is there research, medical research, that the Air Force Medical Service is itself doing that's maybe particularly focused around wartime types of injuries, such as traumatic brain injury that we're hearing so much about, for example?
We've been collaborating with multiple partners around the country on trauma care for over 10 years. We've worked with University of Maryland at Baltimore Shock Trauma. We work at UC Davis out in California. We work with Miami Valley out in at Wright-Patterson. Pretty much everywhere where I have a hospital, I now have training agreements for my physicians to try and work in their level one trauma facilities so that we're learning every day as things change in American medicine, and also that we're bringing back the innovations from and what we're learning in what is probably the mixing bowl where we see the worst trauma in terms of what's happening in the war. Those relationships have allowed us to basically create some research initiatives. So, for instance, at the University of Cincinnati, where we have one of our training programs for our critical care teams, we basically are looking at how do we automate a ventilator? What parameters do we look at so that you could actually have the computer manage the ventilator? And what we've seen in early studies is that we can get someone off a ventilator 50% faster. And although that sounds really important to you folks who think about just healthcare, for me, the other thing, it saves 30% of the oxygen, which means that I don't have to take as much. And so new planning factors can be developed if we find that this type of equipment can actually do that. Now, don't misunderstand me. I want to get people off ventilators 50% faster too, but I really want the logistics planning so that I can do things even faster and make people well even sooner. Okay, and it all comes together that way.
General, improving the resilience and safeguarding the mental health and well-being of service members is critical to sustaining a healthy and fit force. Would you elaborate on your initiatives to optimize mental health access and support among service members? And more particularly, how are you leveraging virtual reality and technology in this area?
We're using several programs to try and do this. We use a lot of telemedicine initiatives to try and link our various mental health shops so that they can talk between one another and share resources. Besides the roughly 80 sites that we now have hooked up through telemedicine so that we can do this, we also are working with the Army and Navy in terms of some outreach for patients who are in remote areas to perhaps give them the ability to link to telemental health. Now, beyond that, we've also got 8 sites where we've set up computer simulations that are we call virtual Iraq, that in essence also decrease the time that it takes for an experienced provider to get to those issues that are causing someone trouble with post-traumatic stress. So you put someone in front of a computer simulator, you essentially take them back to an Iraqi type of situation where they may be in an urban environment being shot at or have sound that basically may trigger them. But once you see what it is that may be causing them recurrent stress or if you get to a point where in the simulation they're unable to continue because of something that's haunting them, it allows them then to share that with the therapist and help them to find ways to deal with that in terms of the therapeutic environment. And so all of these things are being brought to fold to try and improve the situation for our warriors. And all of them are being done not just by the Air Force, but linked by all the services and the VA. And we're not yet sure what's going to be the most effective, but we know that we're on the right track because we're being able to reach some of these patients a little quicker, and we're actually able to reach some of them that are not as accessible because of where they live. This is particularly important for the Guard and Reserve.
General, in an all-volunteer service, Air Force personnel choose to join and serve while their families choose to stay. As this is the year of the Air Force family, would you elaborate on what you're doing to mark the importance of this year?
Well, clearly some of the efforts I've described in the patient-centered medical home are geared towards giving them the continuity and the focus that we think they deserve. Beyond that, we're doing a lot in terms of case management and disease management to try and deal with those things that are everyday diseases, but that if we can find new ways to help them stay healthy, it means that their military member who may be worried about someone with a chronic disease gets to worry a little less as they deploy. Obviously, I think that it helps a great deal to know that if a loved one is going over to defend this country and may be injured, to understand that we will do everything, literally everything, okay, to get these folks home safely if they should become injured, plays a big role in that. And we work a lot to try and make certain that services are available for families and there's continuity by working with the A1, our personnel people, in terms of benefits for the families, and also to make certain that if someone has to become a caregiver for one of the injured for a period of time while they're in rehabilitation, that we're also trying to find ways to compensate them for their time and to work with them to make certain that they do have the time to get people that are injured or need rehabilitation all the way back. We're doing a lot with the VA to try and streamline our benefit systems and try and make certain that any of our wounded warriors that have to go through a medical board process, that if when it's time and they go through those processes, that they understand all of their benefits. We've gone to a single physical exam that's shared by DOD and the VA in terms of determining disabilities. And all of these things have shaved a little more than 2 years in terms of the timing it sometimes took to get some of those VA benefits. It's more than the wounded warriors. A lot of the focus has been on how do we take care of families who have special needs children? How do we partner with local school systems to make sure that when we move our patients from one area to another, even here in the U.S., that we don't change the continuity of services and education? We've established and strengthened our Airmen and Family Readiness Centers on the personnel side to make certain that we can answer their questions and that they have caseworkers, that they have the expertise that they need to get the services that may be needed, whether it's for a short time or even if it's for a more extended time. And we're now working to try and create better databases so that we can match up the skill sets that are required by a family when they go from one station to another so that there is no gap in services if we can avoid it.
What does the future hold for the Air Force Medical Service? We will ask Lieutenant General Bruce Green, Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force, to share with us when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.